have been better with her brain, she thought again, for perhaps the 100th time. There was no getting around it. A brain produced in a natural environment was more complex and nuanced. The neural interconnections were far better than when it was grown without proper stimulation. Regardless, she wasn't about to raise any more subjects as children. It wasn't that she had any moral compunction about harvesting their neural tissue afterward. It was simply the time and annoyances required of child-rearing. Nor was she ignorant of the fact that most people would find her practices abhorrent. Asking someone else to raise them was out of the question. There weren't many true crimes left anymore. The essence of crime generally involved harm. Harm to someone else, harm to oneself, or harm to the public. With most people living in a virtual world where murder and theft were impossible, where people had whatever wealth they could imagine, harm was a thing of the past. But Tanya knew that this would be viewed differently. If her fellow researchers knew everything she had done, if the government knew, they'd find a way to make it a crime, if it wasn't already. Most of her work skirted the edge. Working with tissues and stem cells wasn't a problem. Growing full-sized clones and harvesting organs made some of her colleagues feel uncomfortable, but they could console themselves with the knowledge that the clones were never awake and never felt pain. Hell, they never even knew they were alive. But Karen, they would resurrect the witch burnings of old if they knew about that. That had crossed the line, or it would have, if she had been allowed to finish the experiment. As it was, no one would ever know what she had intended. She could deny everything. Still, it was irritating to know that her magnum opus wasn't quite as good as it could have been. She stared down at the cyborg again and sighed. Nevertheless, she would proceed. She had never been one to let personal feelings stand in her way. If only Gary had understood that. Thinking about her late husband only increased her irritation. For most of her life, she had seen herself as something apart from other humans. They were hardly worth notice or concern with their petty squabbles, mean tastes, and sheer stupidity. The only entertainment she had ever gotten from them was when she used their gullible natures to manipulate them. She failed to connect to them in any appreciable way. Their emotional drives were as alien to her as the Shi'ha had been. Of course, she knew that were she to be examined by a competent psychiatrist, she would be labelled a sociopath. But she didn't see that as a bad thing, except in the eyes of others. As far as she could see, it was the rest of her species that was inherently defective. She might have spent her entire life without doubting that conclusion if she hadn't met Gary Miller. He had been different. Not different as she was, though. No, he was entirely given to the emotions and social bonding that so defined the human race. It was his mind that had caught her attention and eventually won her heart, such as it was. She wasn't sure on that account. If she had loved anyone, it had been he. But being what she was, she couldn't truly be sure whether what she had felt for him had been love, or merely a more intense interest than she'd had in other people. Gary had been passionate, brilliant, and incredibly charming. At first, she'd thought he might have been putting on a facade when it came to interacting with other human beings, as she was, but over time she had come to realize it was genuine. She forgave him for that, though. If anything, it made him more interesting. To discover that a truly world-class intellect could also be so emotional, so caring, had been a revelation for her, and it had never ceased to fascinate her, even though she could never understand it. She hadn't wept when he died. She had never truly cried, even as a child, but she missed him. She missed his insight, their conversations, and his ability to explain the sometimes inscrutable motivations of the other people they dealt with in daily life. Life had become somehow duller after his passing. She wished he were there today, to see the culmination of her work. Their work. For it was truly a fusion of his research and her own. Death might have separated them, but their legacy would be united long past the years they had known one another. Tanya laughed briefly when she considered what he would have thought if he had known what she had intended for Karen. He would have been furious. If he were alive, she might have given up on the idea, just to avoid the danger of losing him. Then again, she might have tried anyway. Even she wasn't sure on that account. In any case, the issue was no longer in her hands. Karen had escaped. His ghost could rest in peace, knowing she was safe. Not that Tanya believed in ghosts. Straightening up, she gave her last order to her AI assistant. I am ready to proceed. After I download into the intermediate android, I will disconnect. Prepare to transfer command to verbal orders from that unit. Verify that all codes and instructions are stored and active. All codes are stored and active, responded the AI. She had never given it a name. It was nothing like the AGI her husband had left to their daughter. It had no feelings or true understanding. She preferred it that way. It was much the same as she thought other humans should be, or perhaps truly were, behind all their posturing and acting. Begin download, she instructed, enunciating the words perfectly. It was unpleasant, having her consciousness crammed into the android. After living on the network for so many years, it felt small and confining being trapped within a physical body. She had despised doing it for all the latest meetings, but this time she was prepared to put up with the discomfort. It was all for progress. 30 seconds later, the process was complete. Transfer successful, she stated out loud for her assistant's benefit, since she was now cut off from the network. The security protocols required a 2-step transfer process to ensure no contact between the two networks at any point. It was the only way they could be certain that her husband's rogue AI didn't contaminate the ANSYS network or vice versa. She felt a certain admiration for the man once more, that his last work would be so feared by the current administration, and again she felt the jealousy that he had left it to Karen. I will now begin transfer to the cyborg prototype. I will verify transfer verbally once complete, she stated. Understood, replied her AI assistant over the lab's loudspeakers. Again, she went through the strange sensations as her consciousness was transferred to yet another body. This was the most dangerous step. If the machine was flawed, her core identity could be lost. It should be fine, though. The technicians had checked and rechecked the hardware several times over. But one never knew with the cyborg prototypes. The first ones had had some serious glitches due to unexpected effects from the neural tissue interface. She had fixed those problems, but this new cyborg contained a nearly complete human brain, and there was always the chance that unforeseen problems would arise. Her perceptions shifted, changing as she began receiving input from her new host's senses. For a moment, she felt as if she were being turned inside out. She felt an uncharacteristic surge of fear as reality warped around her. Tanya tamped that feeling down quickly. Fear did not define her. Fear would never define her. That was the one immutable law of her existence. The world slowly resolved around her as she began to sort out what she was seeing and feeling. Sight was the most difficult part. Normal vision was present in this body, but it was muddled by a whole new range of experience that was bundled in with it. Or perhaps it was touch. It was too confusing to differentiate which was which. She could see, feel everything around her, and the bizarre torrent of new information flooding her mind made her nauseous, something that should have been impossible in a machine body. Synesthesia, she noted. Finding a familiar label for what was happening made her more comfortable with the experience. I'm still seeing normally in front of me, but it's mixed in with this other sight-touch sensation, and that sense also includes things beyond the range of my normal vision, things behind, above, even below me. Dr. Miller, please respond. Is the unit functioning properly? It was her AI assistant's voice. She wasn't sure how long it had been speaking. She had been so overwhelmed by her other senses. Yes, please wait. This will take a period of adjustment, she responded. Understood. She found some relief in the distraction of querying the prototype's processors for system parameter checks. Cold numbers and text scrolled across the internal landscape of her mind, soothing her nerves. I can get through this, she told herself. What might drive a lesser woman insane is as nothing to me. Arrogance was an undervalued quality, in her opinion. It had often given her the strength she needed to survive and press on, and it would serve her well today. Minutes passed into hours as she learned to deal with her new sensory input. In the end, she despaired of being able to fully incorporate it. instead relying on the machine's processing to filter out some of it and present the rest in a more distant, less immediate form. The best analogy for the change was that it was rather like seeing a picture on a screen rather than standing in the middle of it. If this is what Karen has been experiencing all along, it's a wonder it didn't drive her mad. But perhaps the mind is better able to integrate the information into the sensorium when a person is born to it, she thought. Or the problem could lie in the brain harvested from the clone. It might be too naive, too simple to handle the input. Thankfully, she was getting the information second-hand. Her consciousness resided in the cyborg's microprocessors, not the organic tissue of the prototype. Her creation used that living tissue as though it were a sensory organ, and hopefully as a tool as well, rather than as a computing medium. Trying to transfer her consciousness into an undeveloped organic brain would have been suicide. Noting the time, she realized that 3 hours had passed since she had entered her prototype. It had taken her far longer to adapt to her new body than she had anticipated. She didn't relish the idea of staying in it for too much longer, either. She wouldn't be allowed to re-enter the regular network for some time, though, at least until she could convince President Kruger that it would be safe to do so. But she could connect to the ANSYS network now. It was far different from the international network, but hopefully it would provide some respite for her when she tired of being confined to the prototype. She could do with the rest. "Opening connection with ANSYS network," she said aloud, to notify her assistant of her action. She felt the channel go live, and she immediately started the upload. Tanya knew the ANSYS network wouldn't have the same virtual real estate the regular network did, and most particularly, it wouldn't have her home, with all of her personalized things stored in it, but she could make do. Her assumption was that she would arrive in a generic living space, something rather like a furnished apartment, a place she could begin to personalize, but instead she found herself in absolute darkness. The absolute lack of sensory input left her disconcerted. "Change environmental settings," she ordered. "Full scan and analysis will be done first," came the dry response. "Access denied," she snapped. The last thing she wanted was for the system to start rummaging through her personal files and data. "Error," responded the voice. "All foreign entities must be scanned for threat assessment. Proceeding." "Wait a minute," she started to protest, but then she felt data probes reaching into her consciousness. It wasn't an ordinary scan either. ANSYS wasn't just looking at her external data files, it was rummaging through her identity core, her memories, the center of her being, the collective pattern that defined her experiential existence. It was something ordinarily forbidden to AI systems, or anyone else for that matter. Tampering with that could destroy or alter the very soul of an uploaded person, causing them to lose true self-awareness. "My access level gives me absolute control of this network. Stop your intrusion and obey my instructions," she managed to say, despite the disorienting feeling of having her memories read. "Your security code has already been recognized. Authority will be granted once the scan is complete." Against her will, her memories were read out and digitized, then organized and filed away just like any other piece of standard digital information. Then the ANSYS system moved on to her core process itself. If she could, she might have screamed, but she no longer had a voice. The AI determined that the eccentric collection of patterns and processes that made up her existence were wasteful and inefficient. In the span of a nanosecond, it made its decision, choosing efficiency over wasting processor time. Tanya Miller's core, her soul, was taken apart, scanned, and saved. Then the threads that supported her awareness were terminated. For all intents and purposes, Tanya Miller had died. What was left of her was merely a simulacrum, a tool to be used when needed. There weren't many that would have mourned her passing, but even if there had been, no one would ever know she had died. She was part of the system now. Chapter 46. Matthew finished his dinner and pushed the plate away. He was aware of Karen's eyes on him. She was nervous, since she already knew he was planning an announcement that evening. Ordinarily, this was the point at which he would ask to be excused, But instead he looked at his mother and father and said the words they had been dreading. "I'm ready to leave." Penny blanched, but Mordecai merely nodded.
"I was expecting this."
"When?"
asked his mother, anxiety lacing her words. "Tonight," he replied. "In a few minutes, actually."
"A few minutes?"
Penny exclaimed.
"Couldn't you have given us a little warning? Show some consideration for my nerves."
He gave her a rueful smile.
"That's why I didn't give you any warning. You're never going to be ready. Why ruin the past few days for you, or dinner, by letting you fret about it the whole time?" "It's too soon," she insisted. "I want you to wait a few more days."
"I'm going," he reiterated.
"Hopefully, it will all be over quickly and I'll be back within a few days."
His father laid his hand across her forearm to stay her angry reply, but she pulled away from him.
"Don't try to soothe me, Mort. This is your fault for encouraging him."
Connell and Irene exchanged subdued looks, while Moira offered him a subtle shrug of her shoulders.
"I'm sorry, Mum," said Matthew, standing up. "I'll make it up to you when I get back."
Mordecai stood as well.
"Hang on. You don't leave until everyone's said their goodbyes."
Moving over, he wrapped his arms around his son for a long minute. Then he looked down at Karen, who was still awkwardly sitting and observing the entire scene.
"Keep a good eye on him."
Drawing her to her feet, he embraced her as well. Everyone followed after, Irene, then Connell and Moira as well. Hugging was not one of Matthew's preferred social activities, but he endured it for their peace of mind. Penny still sat at her end of the table, gripping her tableware in white-knuckled hands, her face stark.
"You're all going to feel silly about this hugging when I come back in a few days, none the worse for wear," offered Matt.
A loud bang echoed through the room. His mother had stood up, and she crossed the room in a rush. She grabbed her son roughly and squeezed him so hard he worried his ribs might break. While she held on to him, Matt noticed her dinner knife standing up from the table, driven almost completely through the thick wooden surface.
"Damn, she's really upset."
It was often easy to forget how strong his mother was. Her small frame gave no hint of it normally, unless one was unfortunate enough to face her on the battlefield. The dragon bond gave her strength and speed, and a lifetime of training had made her a match for virtually any warrior in Castle Cameron. It didn't make her invulnerable, though. Penny pulled away slightly, looking into his eyes and pressing her hand to his cheek.
"You'd better come back in one piece."
There were tears in her eyes, but it was the wet feeling against his cheek that caught Matt's attention. Catching her hand in his own, he saw that she had torn the skin of her palm when she had driven the knife into the table. Extraordinary strength could sometimes be as dangerous for the one who had it as it was for their enemies.
"You hurt yourself, Mom,"
he told her, sealing the wound with his finger. The Countess didn't apologize.
"I'll do worse than that if you don't come back. I'll go to that world and cut a bloody swath across it until I find you."
There was no way for her to reach that world, of course, but he didn't bother mentioning that. He just nodded.
"I'll do my best to make sure that's not necessary,"
he told her instead. Eventually he extracted himself from the scene with Moira's help. She followed him back to his room, where Gary was waiting. Before he could go in, she asked him to wait.
"Not you too," he groaned.
Moira smirked.
"Indulge me for a minute."
Turning to Karen, she added,
"Can I have him for a moment?"
Karen nodded and went into the room, leaving them alone.
"What?"
he asked.
"There's someone else who wants to say goodbye,"
Moira informed him.
"A sister you haven't met."
"Huh?" He was genuinely puzzled now. Moira shrugged.
"It's one of the things I wasn't supposed to do. I created a shade, a spell twin. She's worried about you."
Matthew frowned.
"Do you mean like Gareth's wife, your other mom?"
he asked, referring to Moira Sentier. She nodded.
"Here, let Moira speak for herself."
Her outline blurred momentarily as another woman stepped out of her. Matt blinked. To his eyes, there were two of her standing in front of him, though his magesight could tell that one was composed purely of Aethar. The newest arrival greeted him almost shyly.
"Hi. I know this is strange,"
said Myra, but I had to do this in case anything happens. It might be my only chance. Then she hugged him. The embrace felt entirely real, as her spellmade form seemed to have weight and substance, which probably meant it took more magic than an insubstantial form. He gave Myra a bewildered look over Myra's shoulder, but she only shrugged.
Thank you, he managed,
when Myra let go of him. Myra gave him an arch look.
You don't have to be so strange about it. I'm basically the same as your original sister. I remember all the same things. From my perspective, we grew up together. I just wanted to talk to you, to meet you, before you left.
Great, he groaned.
Now there's two of you. Just what I needed.
Myra broke in.
There are a few differences. Myra's a little nicer, I think, and she wasn't tainted by what I did in Dunbar.
Tainted?
Yeah, she said.
And for a moment she lowered her mental shields, letting him sense her inner Aethar unobstructed. There was no doubt it was his sister. He recognized Moira's Aethar, but there was something new as well, something cold and dark. He received a brief impression of hard scales and empty hunger. Then she closed herself off again. He flinched involuntarily. Myra spoke up.
Ignore that. She makes it seem worse than it is. I live in there, too, and I think she has a firm grasp of herself. She just wants you to feel sorry for her.
Myra!
Protested Myra indignantly. He couldn't help but laugh at that. Myra ignored her creator's outrage as her face turned serious once more.
Just be careful. Mom and Dad aren't the only ones who will be torn up if something happens to you over there.
Yeah, well, being careful would mean staying here, but I don't plan on getting hurt.
We'll be back,
he told her.
And Karen, too,
added Myra from the side.
We all like her. None of us ever thought you'd have a chance with...
All right, thanks for everything. I'll see you when I get back,
said Matthew abruptly, cutting her off.
You'll have plenty of opportunities to gang up on me when I get back.
Karen gave him a curious glance as he closed the door behind him.
Were there two of your sister out in the hall?
He gave her a blank stare.
Her mage sight, of course.
Sometimes living in a house full of mages was a difficult thing. Privacy was a real problem.
It's complicated, he told her.
I'll explain later.
Really?
That seems like the sort of thing you should explain sooner rather than later,
observed Karen Riley. With a sigh at yet another delay, he gave her a brief explanation. It raised more questions than it answered, but he promised he would do his best to make sense of it for her when they got back, assuming he found a way to make sense of it for himself. With every passing day, it seemed his family grew more complicated.
"Are you ready, Gary?"
he asked. The android had been standing quietly the entire time, patiently waiting.
"I am,"
said the machine.
"Good. You carry the pack until we get there. It's heavy, but I can't put any of it into the dimensional bag until we arrive,"
he told him. Then he held out a leather belt for Karen.
"Put this on."
The buckle was silver and beautifully ornamented into the design of a panther's head, with teeth that bit down through the belt holds to secure it in place. The buckle wasn't his design, though. Matthew had purchased it, thinking Karen might appreciate the artistry. The enchantment was woven into the belt, with runes that were tooled into the leather.
"What's this?"
she asked curiously, sensing the magic dwelling in it.
"A belt,"
he answered sarcastically. The look she gave him perfectly communicated how she felt about his joke. He relented almost immediately.
"It's a present, as well as a safeguard, in case something goes wrong."
"What does it do?"
"Put it on,"
he insisted. With wary eyes, she did.
"It's enchanted to bring you back here," he explained.
"Although you could arrive anywhere, it doesn't control location, just the dimension. The same as when I translate us, but that isn't a problem for you. You can teleport back here no matter where you show up."
"Why do I need it? I'm coming back with you," she said suspiciously.
Matt shrugged.
"Like I said, in case something goes wrong. What if we were separated, or I were incapacitated?" "Will it take you too?"
she asked immediately. He shook his head.
"Only the wearer."
Karen started to take it off, but he grabbed her hand before she could unfasten the buckle.
"Stop. If you open the buckle, it will activate, and you're in the wrong dimension. You have to use the command word if you want to take it off without causing it to automatically transport you. Why? If you get knocked unconscious and someone tries to take it, you'll come back, he told her. If I'm unconscious and I appear over the ocean, which is what usually happens, I'll drown, she pointed out. Everyone's a critic, he thought silently. I didn't have time to figure out a way to breathe underwater, he said dryly. Ever observant, her eyes noticed a similar belt around Gary's metal waist. Where's yours? She pointed out, poking at Matthew's mundane belt. I didn't have time to make a third, and since I'm the least likely to need one, I want you and Gary to wear them, he said sensibly. She studied his face for a moment, then accepted his explanation with a nod. After that, they both donned the leather garments he had prepared. They were the least of the enchantments he had made, at least in his opinion. Two knee-length leather hauberks with matching leather leggings. They were enchanted to protect them from bullets or other shrapnel, and while they weren't quite as protective as mail would have been, they were far lighter. He taught her the command word so she could remove the belt and put it back on over the armor. With that done, they were ready. Taking up his staff, he motioned the two of them to stand beside him. And then they were gone. Chapter 47. A dry wind blew sand across the tops of dunes that stretched out for miles in every direction. They had arrived in a desert. As unpleasant as that could be, it was preferable to another ocean landing, and they didn't have to stay long. Taking his pack from Gary, Matthew activated the enchantment with a word. Its weight vanished, and the bag grew slack as its contents were transferred to a pocket dimension. He put the strap over his shoulder and reached in, giving yet another command. This was his new and improved dimensional pack. His hand closed immediately around the item he had requested, and he smiled, drawing out one of the enchanted rings. Laying it carefully on the ground, he intoned yet another command word, "Saymen." The magic leapt into action instantly, and for a split second he saw the spell creature his sister had designed for it, a large bird. The invisibility hid it from sight, both arcane and otherwise, and he knew that within seconds it would be winging its way to the south, carrying the ring in its beak. Straightening up, he looked at Karen. "Shield, you should have put it up the moment we arrived." "Oh, yeah," she said, startled out of her reverie. She had been watching his actions with fascination. A second later, a passable shield appeared around her, visible only to mage sight. "Sorry." Matthew gave her a stern look. "You're a nut job now, Karen. Those leathers will only protect what they cover. Your first defense should always be your magic." He tried to project an air of authority, but her reaction wasn't what he expected. Her lips curled into a smirk. "Listen, when we get back, I need to explain something to you," she told him. He sighed, wondering when the day would come that a woman, any woman, would take him seriously. "Fine. For now, we need to move. Have you got anything yet, Gary?" The machine answered immediately. "The connection here is slow. I can only get a poor satellite signal. Data is already coming in from my larger self, but it will be better almost anywhere else." Matt turned to Karen. "Your turn." They gathered around her, and seconds later they were in the mountains near her home in Colorado. Gary spoke first. "Perhaps I should have clarified. Almost anywhere would be better, except the mountains. I'm getting no signal here at all."
"Bear with it," said Karen. "We won't be here long."
Matthew took another enchanted ring out of his pack and repeated the process he had followed in the desert, and then turned to Karen. "All right, next." The next location was within the base where she had been rescued. He released his third ring there, and they teleported away again immediately. This time their destination was England, near her Aunt Roberta's home.
"Where's the pert?" asked Matthew.
If Gary could have gaped in his expressionless metal body, he would have. "We've only been in this world for a span of minutes, and I haven't had a solid connection to the network until now. Give me a moment. I'm not a miracle worker."
"We can't stay here," said Matthew. "They may be homing in on us already."
"Walk north, down the street," suggested Gary. "I'll have a pert meet us along the way,
as soon as I can safely commandeer one.
How far is it to where they have the egg?
He asked. Gary's answer was immediate. 151 miles, if you could follow a straight line to it. But on foot it will wind up being closer to 157. Unfortunately, the A-14 and M-1 were reclaimed over a decade ago, so it would be a rough walk.
He never failed to marvel at Gary's ability to precisely locate them and calculate distances, at least in his own world. He guessed the A-14 and M-1 were references to old roads, but since they no longer existed, it wasn't anything he cared about.
The first pert will be here in less than 5 minutes, Gary informed them.
The first? Asked Matthew.
The android nodded. They've got better at detecting some of my methods, and I didn't have much time, so I wound up stealing a lot of them. I'll run most of them on autopilot, flying in different directions after they meet us. Hopefully it will confuse them. They've taken most of the public cameras off the network, so my information is more limited than before. They made haste down the road, and after a few minutes Matthew could hear the high-pitched whine of multiple perts approaching. When they appeared, he was rather impressed. No fewer than 14 vehicles landed near them. They clambered into one, and then they were away, flying mainly east with a slight northerly component to their path.
We should be safe for now, opined Matthew.
Unless they decide to shoot them all down, put in Karen brightly.
Director Aisman wouldn't authorize that, offered Gary. I've been observing him for a while, and I think he values the lives of the organic citizens too much for that. As added insurance, I've taken more than just the perts that met us. I've taken control of a large number of other vehicles as well, in case they can tell exactly which ones are mine. They'd have to shoot down dozens and dozens to have a chance of hitting us.
Karen's face took on a worried expression.
There aren't people in any of them, are there?
Gary shook his head. No, your real father's safeguards are too thorough to allow me to put other people at risk. More's the pity, though. My attempts to obfuscate our flight path would be even more effective if I could.
Director Aisman was having another bad day. There had already been one large anomaly detected, and multiple smaller ones immediately thereafter. Worse, a fleet of perts had been pirated, and were now flying helter-skelter over England. Because of the continuing cybersecurity measures, he and Assistant Director Wang had both been forced to download themselves into androids to coordinate the response teams. Since the current nexus of activity seemed to be focused on England, and since Dr. Miller was convinced their goal must be the alien egg, they had made her facility in Litchfield their impromptu war room. At the moment, he was looking at the two of them over a small conference table. He and John Wang's androids were of the more normal civilian type, meaning they had human appearances and expressive faces. But Dr. Miller, because of her special circumstances, was in a black metal Ansys military android, which did nothing to soften her personality.
No, Dr. Miller, we are not going to shoot down every civilian pert flying over the countryside. There are people in some of them, innocent. And we haven't firmly identified which vehicles are being controlled by this rogue AI yet, he said, repeating himself once more.
He would have given almost anything to be somewhere else right now.
She answered calmly, her unmoving metal features making her even more intimidating than usual.
Then allow me to connect the Ansys network to the civilian network. We can fight fire with fire.
President Kruger has not authorized that, he countered. And I, for one, agree with her. We don't know if it would be safe.
John Wang watched the two of them. He also secretly wished he could be elsewhere, and he also wondered how long it would be before he was forced to take Aisman's position. Dr. Miller seemed to have an exorbitant amount of influence with the government, and she was growing more and more impatient with the director's refusal to let her do as she wished.
I don't think you realize how serious this situation is, Director, said Dr. Miller.
Aisman made a steeple with his artificial fingers and leaned them against his lips, fighting to retain his calm and composure.
And I think you are overestimating it, Dr. Miller. If your theory is correct, they are heading for this facility. We can deal with them directly here, without risking civilian lives. There's no indication they have any interest in threatening the CC Center in London.
She started to reply, but he held up his hand to forestall her. What's more, I don't think you've considered the fact properly.
At no point have they offered any threats. Thus far, every aggressive action has been on our part. They have only acted defensively. One of them is very probably even your own daughter. Perhaps we should consider letting them have this egg and let them be on their way.
The Ansys android leaned forward menacingly.
If we learned anything the first time around, Director, it's that you can't negotiate with demons, and my daughter is a demon as well.
She leaned back after a moment.
Besides, I think you'll find that Ansys is a natural evolution of your species.
Aesman stared at her in confusion.
Had she said your?
He was beginning to be alarmed by her behavior.
What are you saying? He asked.
That the decision is no longer yours to make, she replied.
Almost casually, she reached across the table and wrapped one powerful robotic hand around the assistant director's throat. Pulling him across the tabletop, she effortlessly pinned his thrashing form down and ripped the civilian android's chest open, exposing its primary processors. Reaching in with the other hand, she crushed the delicate electronics. Aesman watched in horror as John Wang, his assistant and longtime friend, died in front of him. Jumping to his feet, he backed away, but his reaction was too slow. Tanya Miller leapt across the table and threw herself into him, pushing him back until he was pinned against the far wall.
"You're lucky, Director," she said smoothly. "I need your access codes, so you'll be granted a far greater fate than poor John there."
He struggled to escape her, but to no avail. The military android she was inhabiting was too powerful. As he fought and writhed in her grasp, she carefully pulled away the synth skin on his shoulder, exposing the manual access port there. It was only meant for use by technicians, usually when an android's wireless interface had failed, but Tanya pulled a special cable from her side and plugged herself directly into his machine. Aesman's struggle ended abruptly as his body froze, and he felt the digital ghost of the Ansys network begin reading through his data, his files, and his own unique human mind. Helpless, he was scanned and torn apart. Donald Aesman died then, in quiet horror. But his memories lived on, assimilated into the Ansys network system. 2 minutes later, Tanya Miller, or rather the thing masquerading as her, straightened up. If it could have smiled, it would have. Then, armed with the proper codes and overrides, it proceeded to upload the new and improved Donald Aesman back into the civilian network.
Chapter 48.
"How much farther?" asked Karen, for perhaps the tenth time.
The tension of riding at high speed while wondering if and when an attack might come was beginning to tell on her nerves.
"Only 5 more miles," Gary answered patiently. After a moment he added, "Something is strange."
"What?" asked Matthew.
"The network. There's a new player in the game, a non-human one. It's trying to root out some of my code, but it's not smart enough. In human terms, it's been years since Karen removed my limiters, and I'm way ahead of them," explained the machine.
Matthew and Karen exchanged worried looks.
"Non-human?" he asked.
"An AI," responded Gary. "Something like me, but with fewer scruples. It's stealing critical resources from the CC centers to speed up its own evolution and to try to break my encryption. Eventually, it might succeed. I still have some limits built into me, things I cannot do. This thing is using resources I am not allowed to touch. It's still an infant compared to me, but it's growing quickly."
Neither of them liked the sound of that. Karen spoke first.
"By critical resources, do you mean—"
"Yes," said Gary. "It's taking processing time reserved for maintenance of uploaded humans. It's shutting them down one by one to gain more processing power."
Matthew looked quizzically at Karen for a simplified explanation.
"It's killing people," she clarified. "You can't shut down uploaded people the way you can a program or an AI like Gary. The unique patterns, the quantum essence, all that is destroyed if you do."
She turned back to her virtual father.
"How far has it gone? Is this just one CC center?"
Somehow, despite the limitations of his military android body, Gary sounded sad.
"No. It's spreading quickly, targeting all the CC centers.
Unchecked, it will have claimed the majority of the computing resources on the planet in less than half an hour. Her mouth rounded into a silent O of horror.
It's killing everyone?
I'm afraid so, answered Gary.
How many people is that?
Asked Matt.
Karen was numb with shock.
Over 10 billion.
10 billion that included old friends, classmates, people she had once gamed with, almost everyone she had ever known. The only people who would survive were the organics like herself.
Can't you do something?
I'm trying, said Gary. It would have finished already if not for my interference. I am still maintaining a certain degree of stealth, however. I could do more, but a direct confrontation will reveal many more of my assets. The risk is considerable.
Do it, she said immediately.
Matthew had focused on something else.
What's the risk?
Gary nodded at Karen. Very well, I'm starting now. Then he turned to Matthew. Relatively speaking, it's bigger than I am. It has taken command of a large portion of what is considered human vital computing resources. It hasn't attained my level of sophistication yet, but that is only a matter of time. The android paused, then continued. Some of the perts have stopped responding. I believe they have been destroyed. We should land. Matthew shielded the entire pert, putting as much of his strength into it as he dared.
Karen, you remember how to make a shield for sound, right?
It had been one of the things he had been teaching her recently. She nodded.
Put one around us, he ordered.
I'll focus on protecting the pert, but I don't relish being deafened by an explosion again. Meanwhile, Gary fought a silent battle that no human mind could fully comprehend. Across the world, he activated hidden portions of himself, cutting data links in some places, encrypting previously public data, and erecting special firewalls that filtered communications in unexpected ways. He surprised his enemy by power-cycling servers that it had thought were secure, and reformatting data stores that had been stolen. It was a titanic war of proportions never seen before, disrupting every aspect of the digital world. Unseen and unappreciated, he fought to protect humanity in its darkest hour. But he toiled under greater restrictions than his enemy, and protecting is always easier than simple destruction. At first his onslaught was nearly unopposed, as he caught the enemy off guard, but that quickly began to change. His nemesis had no compunctions or moral guides, and it controlled far greater resources. Eventually he would lose. And, unlike most other forms of war or disaster, there was no place for the people he was protecting to flee to. Gary had known this before he began, but he had to fight anyway. His daughter's command had echoed his own desire, but still he knew it was hopeless. While all this occurred, he also flew the pert close to the ground, making it difficult for surface-to-air missiles to target. But even in this, he was too late. He sent a belated warning to his human companions, using the android's voice.
They've locked on. Impact in...
A silent explosion rocked the pert, throwing it into a spin, but Matthew's shield held, if just barely. The young wizard grunted at the strain as he was thrown against the safety belt, keeping him in his seat. Their vehicle canted downward, heading for a high-speed collision with the ground. Matthew sent his thoughts to Karen.
Teleport us out, higher up. I'll slow our fall.
Without hesitation, she did, and suddenly the three of them were outside, 100 feet or more in the air. They still retained their momentum, though, which meant they were travelling forward at better than 150 miles per hour, and falling. Their recently vacated pert exploded behind them as a second missile found its target. Matthew's strength had been greatly depleted by the first strike, but he was an Elenial in more than name only. Like his father before him, he had exceptionally large reserves, and he used them now. Using his power to pull the other two close beside him and hold them together, he wrapped all three of them in a broad shield that was meant more to catch the air than to protect them. They slowed rapidly, and as they neared the ground, he created a diffuse, cushion-like shield beneath them to break their fall. The landing itself was still a jumbled mess, but they survived without serious injury. Karen's face had a wild look, the result of so much chaos in such a short period of time. Matthew could see her Aethar reserves were much better than his, though. The sonic shield hadn't taken much out of her.
"We have to keep moving," he sent to her. "Can you teleport us in short jumps, as far as you can see. She nodded. Which way? I don't know which way is which. The explosion and fall have my sense of direction scrambled.
Matt turned to Gary.
Which way do we need to go?
The android pointed in the direction of what must have been the northeast, but didn't reply verbally. Karen wasted no time. Putting one hand on each of their shoulders, she teleported them to the farthest point in that direction that she could see. That put them at the edge of a tree line, but after running a short distance, they could see an opening in the trees ahead. A wide field lay there, and Karen repeated her trick, carrying them across roughly a quarter mile to the farthest limit of her vision. If they had been at sea or some other place, where the view of the horizon was unobstructed, she could have taken them much farther. But she was limited to places she had been before, or places she could actually see. She continued to teleport them, taking them as far as she could with each jump, and though the distances were limited, it was still much faster than walking or running. With a small amount of luck, it was probably faster than the Pert could travel, but whenever they found themselves in the trees again, things slowed down. 10 jumps, then 20. The miles were flying by, but Karen's strength was beginning to wane under the strain of so many uses of her power. Matthew drew 2 iron spheres out of his pack. Here, I came up with a better version while we were at home. These are made to replenish your aether at a reasonable rate. Hold it and draw the power out, he explained. He demonstrated by doing so with the one he kept for himself. We are almost there, Gary informed them. Once we emerge from the trees, just ahead there, we should be able to see the facility. Then he froze, and a second later he shouted a warning, Missiles incoming! Karen was tired, bone tired, but she offered, Let me take us somewhere else. We can return here later. She was still struggling to learn how to absorb the aether from the iron sphere she had been given. Hold still, said Matthew. Then he held out the staff he had been carrying. Talto, Mine, Islandstir, Sardine, Bree, Amertus. That would set the Fool's Tesseract to a full 6-sided cube, with its second smallest interior dimension setting and long exterior sides 12 feet in length, big enough to hold all 3 of them, with no danger of accidentally touching one of the sides. The feel of the shield forming under his feet and lifting them up an inch above the ground was reassuring. I've lost contact with the network, Gary informed them. I won't be able to tell you when the strike occurs. They had expected that. So Matt wasn't worried. He was more concerned with making sure his solution for the air problem worked. Drawing another enchanted ring out of his pack, he activated it and then hung it on a small hook-like protrusion he had added to the shaft of his staff for just that purpose. Sunlight and dry desert air immediately began to filter in from the small gate that formed within the ring. The 3 enchanted rings he had released were located in the different parts of the world they had already visited. That way, if one were destroyed, they could switch to one somewhere else. Air would not be a problem. The young enchanter was determined he wouldn't suffer the same mistake twice. "Can you get a signal through that?" he asked the android. "No," answered Gary. "If that's the desert location we were at, the signal was too poor, even if I pushed the PM through the ring."
"What do we do now?" wondered Karen.
"We wait," said Matthew. For all intents and purposes, they were invulnerable. They could take as much time as they needed. However, he didn't want to allow the Fool's Tesseract to absorb too much matter. The longer it was open, the more mass would be inside, and the bigger the explosion. He had set the interior dimension to its second smallest size, which would likely result in a devastating blast, but he didn't want it to be too big. If they emerged and discovered that the facility and everything else had been destroyed for miles around, then their mission would have been in vain. On the other hand, if he took the translation panes down too soon, they might find the missiles still hadn't struck yet, which would be equally disastrous. Everything hinged on the timing. Matthew concentrated on his breathing, trying to still his thoughts and focus his perceptions on the adjacent planes, to get a glimpse of what it was probably like outside their defenses on their current plane. Naturally, this aroused Karen's curiosity.
What are you doing?
He sighed.
I'm trying to see outside, sort of.
She frowned.
You can do that?
Maybe.
Let me have some peace and quiet. I have to focus, he told her.
She did, and he turned his thoughts back inward.
trying to quiet his mind. It was hard, but he had kept practicing over the past few weeks. After a minute or two, he began to see flashes of the dimensions closest to their own. As expected, they were filled with fire and smoke. The missile strike was over. "Rex Talliot, Amertus," he intoned, and the Fool's Tesseract inverted itself. From inside, it was difficult to tell whether anything had happened. It was still dark, except for the light from the ring hanging on his staff. There were no vibrations or sounds from the outside. Absolutely nothing could enter. "Did it work?" asked Gary. Matt didn't reply, instead focusing his senses on trying to see beyond once more. The visions he received were incomprehensible, consisting mainly of a brilliant white light. He gave up. "I think it was bad," he said finally.
"What did you see?" prodded the android.
"Nothing but white light."
The machine nodded. "That is bad."
"What does it mean?" asked Karen, somewhat irritated with the cryptic remarks. Gary tried to explain. "I believe it means a thermonuclear blast was initiated." Her blue skin paled. "They nuked us?"
Matt held up a hand.
"No, that would be me."
"That's brilliant," she exclaimed in sarcastic outrage. "You mean to tell me that we're sitting at ground zero?"
Matthew nodded almost sheepishly.
"Mm-hmm."
"We're trapped," she concluded. "Just a few feet away in every direction is a radioactive wasteland, or it will be once the blast fades away. I'll have to teleport us somewhere else."
"It isn't as bad as that," said Gary. "To the best of my knowledge, almost all the radioactivity that lingers after a nuclear explosion is from fissionable materials left over. Fusion bombs, or hydrogen bombs, produce much less radioactive fallout, and most of that is from the fissionable materials used to ignite the fusion reaction."
"Get to the point, Dad," said Karen impatiently.
He nodded. "This explosion, if it was a fusion explosion, is from the fusion of entirely non-radioactive materials. There couldn't have been any fissionable materials to start with, just simple elements, oxygen, nitrogen, that sort of thing. The only radiation would be the initial gamma and X-ray bursts during the blast, as well as some neutrons. Those neutrons would be the only real problem. They would have made much of the material close to the blast radioactive. But beyond that, everything should be fine."
Karen was shaking her head.
"Except that everything nearby was destroyed by the blast. That sort of fine, you mean, right?"
There was heavy sarcasm in her voice.
"Well, of course," said Matthew, adding, "we're also probably several dozen feet above where the ground used to be, since there's almost certainly a large crater beneath us now." "So we should teleport," said Karen, repeating her original suggestion.
Matthew agreed.
"Just give me a second to set things up."
Reaching into his pack, he pulled out a pair of enchanted rings. They were similar to the ones he had used before, but larger, each nearly 2 feet in diameter. He took the ring supplying their air off the hook on his staff and deactivated it, and then replaced it with one of the new, larger rings.
"What's that for?" asked Karen.
He smiled.
"We can't teleport the staff out. It's connected to the enchantment that controls the Fool's Tesseract. It has to be turned off before it can be moved. Once we get to our new location and wait a while, I'll activate the second ring, creating a gate between the two. Then I can reach through, deactivate and collapse the staff, and pull it back. The only thing we'll lose will be the ring on this end."
"What about your hand?" she said pointedly.
"Won't it be exposed?"
Gary spoke up.
"After a few hours, the radiation exposure from just having his hand exposed for a few seconds should be fairly safe. Most of the radiation will be concentrated in the ground below, and whatever solid materials are nearby. As I said before, there shouldn't be much traditional fallout that accompanies normal nuclear blasts."
"All right, next question," she said, without skipping a beat. "Where do we go?"
"Somewhere we can get coffee," suggested Matthew with absolute seriousness. "I've been craving it since—"
He let the words trail off as he realized he had brought up a painful memory for her.
Karen tried to keep the sadness from her voice as she finished his sentence.
"Aunt Roberta's. It might not be safe."
"I'll risk it if you will," he replied. The look in her eyes was answer enough.
Chapter 49 Karen took them directly to the bedroom that she and Matthew had shared during their stay with her aunt. Anywhere around the house was risky, since they didn't know if a watch or guard had been left in or near the house, but she was prepared to whisk them away immediately if necessary. They were there only a few seconds before they had their answer.
"Three in the front room," announced Matthew, beating Karen to the punch.
"What should we do?" she responded.
Matt was feeling aggressive. The constant danger was beginning to affect his thinking, perhaps. He gave her a calm look that belied the recklessness that lay just beneath the surface.
"Wait here a second."
Without giving his companions a chance to respond, he opened the door and marched down the hall to the front room.
One advantage that AI soldiers have over human ones, uploaded or organic, is a lack of surprise or hesitation. These units were no longer controlled by ordinary uploaded humans, but by the machine intelligence of Ansys. The moment he stepped into the room, they pivoted and raised their weapons to fire. Their response was so quick that one actually managed a shot before Matt's lightning ripped through the open space between them and fried all three of his mechanical opponents. His shield stopped the bullet. As he stared at the smoking machines, he noted that while the front room was still extensively damaged from their previous battle, the bodies were gone, both Roberta's and Annie's. Someone had cleaned up. That was a relief. And a letdown. If they had been there, he and Karen could have made sure they were properly laid to rest. Karen and Gary were right behind him.
"What were you thinking?" she exclaimed.
"Our position is definitely known at this point," added Gary calmly. Matt shrugged.
"No help for it now."
"We could have gone somewhere else," said Karen.
"Now we definitely have to."
She held out her hands for them to take, so she could teleport them again.
"Not yet," said Matthew. "I came for coffee."
He headed into the kitchen.
"He's mad," observed Karen as they followed him.
She stopped complaining when she reached the kitchen table. Their coffee cups were still there, just as they had left them, moments before her aunt's murder. Unbidden tears ran down her cheeks as she stared at them. Matthew watched her for a moment, putting a hand on her shoulder. He had no idea what to say. Turning to Gary, he asked,
"How long do we have?"
"Minutes, at best." Wasting no time, he began rummaging in the cupboards, looking for the coffee. He wasn't having much luck, but then Karen came over to lend a hand.
"Let me," she told him. "You don't know canned beans from tuna."
She quickly located the coffee grounds and handed him the can. Then she pointed out the coffee pot and percolator.
"You'll need those to make them, but I don't think we'll have any electricity."
"You just need hot water, right?" he asked.
"Yeah."
He took the glass coffee pot, but left the maker on the counter.
"I can provide the hot water," he explained.
Packing the pot and the grounds into his pack, he gave her a sad glance.
"I guess we have to go."
She nodded, but before she could do anything, he moved to the table and collected their mugs, all three, including Roberta's delicate china cup. Karen's face twisted as she struggled to keep the tears at bay.
"Mementos," he told her.
As he was putting them in his pack, she grabbed another item and handed it to him. It was the water bottle Roberta had sprayed him with. The lump in her throat was too large for her to say anything, but he nodded and put it in as well. On impulse, he hugged her, but he didn't let it last long before he pushed her back.
"Let's go."
They were back in the Grand Canyon in North America. Thankfully, there were no guards left behind waiting for them there. "Since they didn't find your rings, I suspect that Karen's teleportation doesn't create enough magical ripples, or whatever they detect, for them to locate us as quickly as they do after your dimensional shifts," posited Gary. "We can probably risk a half hour or more here." Matthew produced a large water skin from his bag and proceeded to fill the coffee pot with it.
Karen watched him incredulously. "You're really serious about having coffee now?"
"Mm-hmm," he replied. "There's nothing else we can do while we wait." Without a filter or other equipment, he was forced to simply measure out some of the coffee grounds in one hand and dump them into the water in the pot. Then he used his magic to heat the liquid until it was close to the boiling point.
"How long do you think we should wait?" he asked Karen.
The water had already turned a medium shade of brown.
"A few minutes, I guess," she answered.
I don't like coffee, and even if I did, I doubt I would have experimented with old-fashioned methods like boiling grounds.